This is Audible.
Harlequin Audio is proud to bring you The Orphan's Tale by Pam Genoff. Performed by Jennifer Wydra and Kyla Garcia.
Prologue. Paris. They will be looking for me by now. I pause on the granite steps of the museum, reaching for the railing to steady myself. Pain, sharper than ever, creaks through my left hip, not perfectly healed from last year's break. Across the avenue, Winston Churchill, behind the glass dome of the Grand Palais, the March sky is rosy at dusk. I peer around the edge of the arched entranceway of the Petit Palais. From the massive stone columns hangs a red banner 2 stories high. Dieu sens en de magie de cirque. 200 years of circus magic. It is festooned with elephants, a tiger and a clown, their colors so much brighter in my memories. I should have told someone I was going. They would have only tried to stop me, though. My escape, months in the planning since I'd read about the upcoming exhibit in the Times, had been well orchestrated. I had bribed an aide at the nursing home to take the photo I needed to mail to the passport office. Paid for the plane ticket in cash. I'd almost been caught when the taxicab I'd called pulled up in front of the home in the pre-dawn darkness and honked loudly. But the guard at the desk remained asleep. Summoning my strength now, I begin to climb again, taking each painful step one by one. Inside the lobby, the opening gala is already in full swing. Clusters of men in tuxedos and women in evening gowns mingling beneath the elaborately painted dome ceiling. Conversations in French bubble around me like a long-forgotten perfume I am desperate to inhale. Familiar words trickle back, first in a stream, then a river, though I've scarcely heard them in half a century. I do not stop at the reception desk to check in. They are not expecting me. Instead, dodging the butler d'hors d'oeuvres and champagne, I make my way along the mosaic floors, past walls of murals to the circus exhibit, its entrance marked by a smaller version of the banner outside. There are photos blown up and hung from the ceiling by wire, too fine to see. Images of a sword swallower and dancing horses and still more clowns. From the labels below each picture, the names come back to me like a song. Lorch, Dionis, Neuhoff. Great European circus dynasties felled by war and time. At the last of these names, my eyes begin to burn. Beyond the photos hangs a tall, worn placard of a woman, suspended from silk ropes by her arms, one leg extended behind her in a mid-air arabesque. Her youthful face and body are barely recognizable to me. In my mind, the song of the carousel begins to play tinny and faint, like a music box. I feel the searing heat of the lights, so hot it could almost peel off my skin. A flying trapeze hangs above the exhibit, fixed as if in mid-flight. Even now, My almost 90-year-old legs ache with yearning to climb up there. But there is no time for memories. Getting here took longer than I thought. Like everything else these days. And there isn't a minute to spare. Pushing down the lump in my throat, I press forward, past the costumes and headdresses, artifacts of a lost civilization. Finally, I reach the rail car. Some of the side panels have been removed to reveal the close, tiny berths inside. I am struck by the compact size, less than half my shared room at the nursing home. It had seemed so much larger in my mind. Had we really lived in there for months on end? I reach out my hand to touch the rotting wood. Though I had known the rail car was the same the minute I had seen it in the paper, some piece of my heart had been too afraid to believe it until now. Voices grow louder behind me. I glance quickly over my shoulder. The reception is breaking up and the attendees drawing closer to the exhibit. In a few more minutes, it will be too late. I look back once more, then crouch to slip beneath the roped stanchion. "Hide," a voice seems to say, the long-buried instinct rising up in me once more. Instead, I run my hand under the bottom of the rail car. The compartment is there, exactly as I remembered. The door still sticks, but if I press on it just so, it snaps open. And I imagine the rush of excitement of a young girl looking for a scribbled invitation to a secret rendezvous. But as I reach inside, my fingers close around cold, dark space. The compartment is empty, and the dream I had that it might hold the answers evaporates like cool mist.
Chapter 1. Noah. Germany, 1944. The sound comes low like the buzzing of the bees that once chased Papa across the farm and caused him to spend a week swathed in bandages. I set down the brush I'd been using to scrub the floor, once elegant marble now cracked beneath boot heels and set with fine lines of mud and ash that will never lift. Listening for the direction of the sound, I cross the station beneath the sign announcing in bold black, Bahnhof Bensheim, a big name for nothing more than a waiting room, with two toilets, a ticket window, and a Wurst stand that operates when there is meat to be had and the weather is not awful. I bend to pick up a coin at the base of one of the benches, pocket it. It amazes me the things that people forget or leave behind. Outside, my breath rises in puffs in the February night air. The sky is a collage of ivory and gray, more snow threatening. The station sits low in a valley, surrounded by lush hills of pine trees on three sides, their pointed green tips poking out above snow-covered branches. The air has a slightly burnt smell. Before the war, Bensheim had been just another tiny stop that most travelers pass through without noticing. But the Germans make use of everything, it seems, and the location is good for parking trains and switching out engines during the night. I've been here almost 4 months. It hadn't been so bad in the autumn, and I was happy to find shelter after I'd been sent packing with 2 days' worth of food, three if I stretched it. The girls' home where I lived after my parents found out I was expecting and kicked me out had been located far from anywhere in the name of discretion, and they could have dropped me off in Mainz, or at least the nearest town. They simply opened the door, though, dismissing me on foot. I'd headed to the train station before realizing that I had nowhere to go. More than once during my months away, I had thought of returning home, begging forgiveness. It was not that I was too proud. I would have gotten down on my knees if I thought it would do any good. But I knew from the fury in my father's eyes, the day he forced me out, that his heart was closed. I could not stand rejection twice. In a moment of luck, though, the station had needed a cleaner. I peer around the back of the building now toward the tiny closet where I sleep on a mattress on the floor. The maternity dress is the same one I wore the day I left the home, except that the full front now hangs limply. It will not always be this way, of course. I will find a real job, one that pays in more than not-quite-moldy bread, and a proper home. I see myself in the train station window. I have the kind of looks that just fit in, dishwater hair that whitens with the summer sun, pale blue eyes. Once my plainness bothered me. Here, it is a benefit. The two other station workers, the ticket girl and the man at the kiosk, come and then go home each night, hardly speaking to me. The travelers pass through the station with the daily edition of Der Stummer tucked under their arms, grinding cigarettes into the floor, not caring who I am or where I came from. Though lonely, I need it that way. I cannot answer questions about the pest. No, they do not notice me. I see them, though. The soldiers on leave, and the mothers and wives who come each day to scan the platform, hopefully for a son or husband, before leaving alone. You can always tell the ones who are trying to flee. They try to look normal, as if just going on vacation. But their clothes are too tight from the layers padded underneath, and bags so full they threaten to burst at any second. They do not make eye contact, but hustle their children along with pale, strained faces. The buzzing noise grows louder and more high-pitched. It is coming from the train I'd heard screech in earlier, now parked on the far track. I start toward it, past the nearly empty coal bins, most of their stores long taken for troops fighting in the east. Perhaps someone has left on an engine, or other machinery. I do not want to be blamed, and risk losing my job. Despite the grimness of my situation, I know it could be worse, and that I am lucky to be here. Lucky. I'd heard it first from an elderly German woman, who shared some herring with me on the bus to Den Haag after leaving my parents. "You are the Aryan ideal," she told me, between fishy lip smacks, as we wound through detours and cratered roads. I thought she was joking. I had plain blonde hair and a little stump of a nose. My body was sturdy, athletic, until it had begun to soften and grow curvy. Other than when the German had whispered soft words into my ear at night, I had always considered myself unremarkable. But now I'd been told I was just right. I found myself confiding in the woman about my pregnancy and how I had been thrown out. She told me to go to Wiesbaden and scribbled a note saying I was carrying a child of the Reich. I took it and went. It did not occur to me whether it was dangerous to go to Germany or that I should refuse. Somebody wanted children like mine. My parents would have sooner died than accepted help from the Germans. But the woman said they would give me shelter. How bad could they be? I had nowhere else to go. I was lucky, they said, again when I reached the girls' home. Though Dutch, I was considered of Aryan race, and my child, otherwise shamed as an unheerliches Kind, conceived out of wedlock, might just be accepted into the Lebensborn program and raised by a good German family. I'd spent nearly 6 months there, reading and helping with the housework, until my stomach became too bulky. The facility, if not grand, was modern and clean, designed to deliver babies in good health to the Reich. I'd gotten to know a sturdy girl called Eva who was a few months further along than me. But one night she awoke in blood, and they took her to the hospital, and I did not see her again. After that, I kept to myself. None of us would be there for long. My time came on a cold October morning, when I stood up from the breakfast table at the girls' home, and my water broke. The next 18 hours were a blur of awful pain, punctuated by words of command, without encouragement or a soothing touch. At last the baby had emerged with a wail, and my entire body shuddered with emptiness, a machine shutting down. A strange look crossed the nurse's face. "What is it?" I demanded. I was not supposed to see the child, but I struggled against pain to sit upright. "What's wrong?"
"Everything is fine," the doctor assured. "The child is healthy."
His voice was perturbed, though, face stormy through thick glasses above the draped cream sheet. I leaned forward, and a set of piercing coal eyes met mine. Those eyes that were not Aryan. I understood then the doctor's distress. The child looked nothing like the perfect race. Some hidden gene, on my side or the German's, had given him dark eyes and olive skin. He would not be accepted into the Lebensborn program. My baby cried out, shrill and high-pitched, as though he had heard his fate and was protesting. I had reached for him through the pain. "I want to hold him." The doctor and the nurse, who had been recording details about the child on some sort of form, exchanged uneasy looks.
"We don't. That is, the Lebensborn program does not allow that."
I struggled to sit up. "Then I'll take him and leave." It had been a bluff. I had nowhere to go. I had signed papers giving up my rights when I arrived in exchange for letting me stay. There were hospital guards. I could barely even walk. "Please, let me have him for a second."
"Nein."
The nurse shook her head emphatically, slipping from the room as I continued to plead. Once she was out of sight, something in my voice forced the doctor to relent.
"Just for a moment," he said,
reluctantly handing me the child. I stared at the red face, inhaled the delicious scent of his head that was pointed from so many hours of struggling to be born, and I focused on his eyes. Those beautiful eyes. How could something so perfect not be their ideal? He was mine, though. A wave of love crested and broke over me. I had not wanted this child, but in that moment, all the regret washed away, replaced by longing. Panic and relief swept me under. They would not want him now. I'd have to take him home, because there was no other choice. I would keep him, find a way. Then the nurse returned and ripped him from my arms.
"No! Wait!" I protested.
As I struggled to reach for my baby, something sharp pierced my arm. My head swam. Hands pressed me back on the bed. I faded, still seeing those dark eyes. I awoke alone in that cold, sterile delivery room, without my child, or a husband, or mother, or even a nurse. An empty vessel that no one wanted anymore. They said afterward that he went to a good home. I had no way of knowing if they were telling the truth. I swallow against the dryness of my throat, forcing the memory away. Then I step from the station into the biting cold air, relieved that the Schutzpolizei der Reich, the leering state police who patrol the station, are nowhere to be seen. Most likely they are fighting the cold in their truck with a flask. I scan the train, trying to pinpoint the buzzing sound. It comes from the last boxcar, adjacent to the caboose. Not from the engine. No, the noise comes from something inside the train. Something alive. I stop. I have made it a point to never go near the trains, to look away when they pass by, because they are carrying Jews. I was still living at home in our village the first time I had seen the sorry roundup of men, women, and children in the market square. I had run to my father, crying. He was a patriot, and stood up for everything else. Why not this?
It's awful, he conceded through his graying beard, stained yellow from pipe smoke.
He had wiped my tear-stained cheeks and given me some vague explanation about how there were ways to handle things. But those ways had not stopped my classmate, Steffi Klein, from being marched to the train station with her younger brother and parents in the same dress she'd worn to my birthday a month earlier. The sound continues to grow, almost a keening now, like a wounded animal in the brush. I scan the empty platform and peer around the edge of the station. Can the police hear the noise, too? I stand uncertainly at the platform's edge, peering down the barren railway tracks that separate me from the boxcar. I should just walk away. Keep your eyes down. That has been the lesson of the years of war. No good ever came from noticing the business of others. If I am caught nosing into parts of the station where I do not belong, I will be let go from my job, left without a place to live, or perhaps even arrested. But I have never been any good at not looking. Too curious, my mother said when I was little. I have always needed to know. I step forward, unable to ignore the sound that, as I draw closer now, sounds like cries. Or the tiny foot that is visible through the open door of the rail car. I pull back the door.
Oh!
My voice echoes dangerously through the darkness, inviting detection. There are babies, tiny bodies, too many to count, lying on the hay-covered floor of the rail car, pecked close and atop one another. Most do not move, and I can't tell whether they are dead or sleeping. From amid the stillness, piteous cries mix with gasps and moans like the bleeding of lambs. I grasp the side of the rail car, struggling to breathe over the wall of urine and feces and vomit that assaults me. Since coming here, I have dulled myself to the images, like a bad dream or a film that couldn't possibly be real. This is different, though. So many infants, all alone, ripped from the arms of their mothers. My lower stomach begins to burn. I stand helplessly in front of the boxcar, frozen in shock. Where had these babies come from? They must have just arrived, for surely they could not last long in the icy temperatures. I have seen the trains going east for months, people where the cattle and sacks of grain should have been. Despite the awfulness of the transport, I had told myself they were going somewhere like a camp or a village, just being kept in one place. The notion was fuzzy in my mind, but I imagined somewhere maybe with cabins or tents like the seaside campsite south of our village in Holland, for those who couldn't afford a real holiday or preferred something more rustic. Resettlement. In these dead and dying babies, though, I see the wholeness of the lie. I glance over my shoulder. The trains of people are always guarded. But here, there is no one, because there is simply no chance of the infants getting away. Closest to me lies a baby with gray skin, its lips blue. I try to brush the thin layer of frost from its eyelashes, but the child is already stiff and gone. I yank my hand back, scanning the others. Most of the infants are naked or just wrapped in a blanket or cloth, stripped of anything that would have protected them from the harsh cold. But in the center of the car, two perfect pale pink booties stick stiffly up in the air, attached to a baby who is otherwise naked. Someone had cared enough to knit those, stitch by stitch. A sob escapes through my lips. A head peeks out among the others. Straw and feces cover its heart-shaped face. The child does not look pained or distressed, but wears a puzzled expression as if to say,
Now what am I doing here? There is something familiar about it. Cold dark eyes piercing through me, just as they had the day I had given birth. My heart swells. The baby's face crumples suddenly, and it squalls. My hands shoot out, and I strain to reach it over the others before anyone else hears. My grasp falls short of the infant, who wails louder. I try to climb into the car, but the children are packed so tightly, I can't manage for fear of stepping on one. Desperately, I strain my arms once more, just reaching. I pick up the crying child, needing to silence it. Its skin is icy as I pluck it from the car, naked save for a soiled cloth diaper. The baby, in my arms now, only the second I'd ever held, seems to calm in the crook of my elbow. Could this possibly be my child, brought back to me by fate or chance? The child's eyes close, and its head bows forward. Whether it is sleeping or dying, I cannot say. Clutching it, I start away from the train. Then I turn back. If any of those other children are still alive, I am their only chance. I should take more. But the baby I am holding cries again, the shrill sound cutting through the silence. I cover its mouth and run back into the station. I walk toward the closet where I sleep. Stopping at the door, I look around desperately. I have nothing. Instead, I walk into the woman's toilet, the usually dank smell hardly noticeable after the boxcar. At the sink, I wipe the filth from the infant's face with one of the rags I use for cleaning. The baby is warmer now, but two of its toes are blue, and I wonder if it might lose them. Where did it come from? I open the filthy diaper. The child is a boy, like my own had been. Closer now, I can see that his tiny penis looks different from the German's, or that of the boy at school who had shown me his when I was 7. Circumcised. Steffi had told me the word once, explaining what they had done to her little brother. The child is Jewish, not mine. I step back as the reality I had known all along sinks in. I cannot keep a Jewish baby, or a baby at all, by myself and cleaning the station 12 hours a day. What had I been thinking? The baby begins to roll sideways from the ledge by the sink where I had left him. I leap forward, catching him before he falls to the hard tile floor. I am unfamiliar with infants, and I hold him at arm's length now, like a dangerous animal. But he moves closer, nuzzling against my neck. I clumsily make a diaper out of the other rag, then carry the child from the toilet and out of the station, heading back toward the rail car. I have to put him back on the train, as if none of this ever happened. At the edge of the platform, I freeze. One of the guards is now walking along the tracks, blocking my way back to the train. I search desperately in all directions. Close to the side of the station sits a milk delivery truck, the rear stacked high with large cans. Impulsively, I start toward it. I slide the baby into one of the empty jugs, trying not to think about how icy the metal must be against his bare skin. He does not make a sound, but just stares at me helplessly. I duck behind a bench as the truck door slams. In a second it will leave, taking the infant with it. And no one will know what I have done.
Chapter 2. Astrid. Germany, 1942, 14 months earlier. I stand at the edge of the withered grounds that had once been our winter quarters. Though there has been no fighting here, the valley looks like a battlefield. Broken wagons and scrap metal scattered everywhere. A cold wind blows through the hollow window frames of the deserted cabins, sending tattered fabric curtains wafting upward before they fall, deflated. Most of the windows are shattered, and I try not to wonder if that had happened with time,
or if someone had smashed them in a struggle or rage. The creaking doors are open. Properties fallen into disrepair, as they surely never would have if Mama had been here to care for them. There is a hint of smoke on the air, as though someone has been burning brush recently. In the distance, a crow cries out in protest. Drawing my coat closer around me, I walk away from the wreckage and start up toward the villa that once was my home. The grounds are exactly as they had been when I was a girl, the hill rising before the front door in that way that sent the water rushing haphazardly into the foyer when the spring rains came. But the garden where my mother tended hydrangeas so lovingly each spring is withered and crushed to dirt. I see my brothers wrestling in the front yard before being cowed into practice, scolded for wasting their energy and risking an injury that would jeopardize the show. As children, we loved to sleep under the open sky in the yard in summer, fingers intertwined, the sky a canopy of stars above us. I stop. A large red flag with a black swastika hangs above the door. Someone, a high-ranking SS officer no doubt, has moved into the home that once was ours. I clench my fists, sickened to think of them using our linens and dishes, soiling Mama's beautiful sofa and rugs with their boots. Then I look away. It is not the material things for which I mourn. I search the windows of the villa, looking in vain for a familiar face. I had known that my family was no longer here, ever since my last letter returned undeliverable. I had come anyway, though, some part of me imagining life unchanged, or at least hoping for a clue as to where they had gone. But wind blows through the desolate grounds. There is nothing left anymore. I should not be here either, I realize. Anxiety quickly replaces my sadness. I cannot afford to loiter and risk being spotted by whoever lives here now, or face questions about who I am and why I have come. My eyes travel across the hill toward the adjacent estate where the Circus Neuhof has their winter quarters. Their hulking slate villa stands opposite ours, two sentries guarding the Rheinhessen Valley between. Earlier, as the train neared Darmstadt, I saw a poster advertising the Circus Neuhof. At first, my usual distaste at the name rose. Klempt and Neuhof were rival circuses, and we had competed for years trying to outdo one another. But the circus, though dysfunctional, was still a family. Our two circuses had grown up alongside one another, like siblings in separate bedrooms. We had been rivals on the road. In the off-season, though, we children went to school and played together, sledding down the hill and occasionally sharing meals. Once, when Herr Neuhof had been felled by a bad back and could not serve as ringmaster, we sent my brother Jules to help their show. I have not seen Herr Neuhof in years, though. And he is Gentile, so everything has changed. His circus flourishes, while ours is gone. No, I cannot expect help from Herr Neuhof, but perhaps he knows what became of my family. When I reach the Neuhof estate, a maidservant I do not recognize opens the door. "Guten Abend," I say. "Is Herr Neuhof here?" I am suddenly shy, embarrassed to arrive unannounced on their doorstep like some sort of beggar. "I'm Ingrid Klempt," I use my maiden name. The woman's face reveals that she already knows who I am, though from the circus or from somewhere else, I cannot tell. my departure years earlier had been remarkable, whispered about for miles around. One did not leave to marry a German officer as I had, especially if one was Jewish. Eric had first come to the circus in the spring of 1934. I noticed him from behind the curtains. It is a myth that we cannot see the audience beyond the lights. Not only because of his uniform, but because he sat alone without a wife or children. I was not some young girl easily wooed, but nearly 29. Busy with the circus and constantly on the road, I had assumed that marriage had passed me by. Eric was impossibly handsome, though, with a strong jaw marred only by a cleft chin and square features softened by the bluest of eyes. He came a second night, and pink roses appeared before my dressing room door. We courted that spring, and he made the long trip down from Berlin every weekend to the cities where we performed to spend time with me between shows and on Sundays. We should have known even then that our relationship was doomed. Though Hitler had just come to power a year earlier, the Reich had already made clear its hatred for the Jews. But there was passion and intensity in Eric's eyes that made everything around us cease to exist. When he proposed, I didn't think twice. We did not see the problems that loomed large, making our future together impossible. We simply looked the other way. My father had not fought me on leaving with Eric. I expected him to rebuke me for marrying a non-Jew, but he only smiled sadly when I told him. "I always thought you would have taken over the show for me," he'd said, his sad chocolate eyes a mirror of my own behind his spectacles. I was surprised. I had 3 older brothers, 4 if you counted Isidore, who had been killed at Verdun. There was no reason to think that Papa might have considered me. "Especially with Jules taking his own branch of the show to Nice, and the twins," Papa had shaken his head ruefully. Matthias and Marcus were strong and graceful, performing acrobatic marvels that made the audience gasp. Their skills were purely physical, though. "It was you, Liebchen, with the head for business and the flair of showmanship. But I'm not going to keep you like a caged animal." I'd never known he saw me that way. Only now I was leaving him. I could have changed my mind and stayed, but Eric and the life I thought I always wanted beckoned. So I left for Berlin, taking Papa's blessing with me. Perhaps if I hadn't, my family might still be here. The maid ushers me to a sitting room that, though still grand, shows signs of wear. The rugs are a bit frayed, and there are some spaces in the silver cabinet that are empty, as though the bigger pieces had been taken or sold. Stale cigar smoke mixes with the scent of lemon polish. I peer out the window, straining to see my family's estate through the fog that has settled above the valley. I wonder who lives in our villa now, and what they see when they look down at the barren, deserted winter quarters. After our wedding, a small ceremony with a justice of the peace, I moved into Eric's spacious apartment overlooking the Tiergarten. I spent my days strolling the shops along Bergmannstrasse, buying richly colored paintings and rugs and embroidered satin pillows. Little things that would make his once sparse quarters our home. Our biggest dilemma was which cafe to frequent for Sunday brunch. I'd been in Berlin for almost 5 years when the war broke out. Eric received a promotion to something I didn't understand, having to do with munitions, and his days became longer. He would come home, either dark or moody, or heady with excitement about things he could not share with me.
It will all be so different when the Reich is victorious, trust me.
But I didn't want different. I liked our life just as it had been. What was so wrong with the old ways? Things had not gone back to the way they had been, though. Instead, they worsened rapidly. They said awful things about Jews on the radio and in the newspapers. Jewish shop windows were broken, and doors painted.
My family,
I'd fretted to Eric over brunch in our Berlin apartment, after I'd seen the windows of a Jewish butcher shop on Orienburger Straße shattered. I was the wife of a German officer. I was safe. But what about my family back home?
Nothing will hurt them, Ina,
he soothed, rubbing my shoulders.
If it's happening here, I pressed, then Darmstadt can be no better.
He wrapped his arms around me.
There have just been a few acts of vandalism in the city. A showing. Look around you. Everything is fine.
The apartment was scented with the smell of rich coffee. A pitcher of fresh orange juice sat on the table. Surely it could not be so much worse elsewhere. I rested my head on the broad shelf of Eric's shoulder, inhaling the familiar warmth of his neck.
The Klemmt family circus is internationally known, he reassured.
He was right. Our family circus had been generations in the making, born from the old horse shows in Prussia. My great-great-grandfather, they said, had left the Lipizzaner stallions in Vienna to start our first circus. And the next generation had followed, and the one after that. The very oddest sort of family business. Eric continued.
That's why I stopped to see the show on my way back from Munich that day. And then I saw you.
He pulled me onto his lap. I raised my hand, cutting him off. Normally, I loved his retelling of how we met, but I was too worried to listen.
I should go check on them.
How will you find them on tour?
He asked, a note of impatience creeping into his voice. It was true. Midsummer, they could be almost anywhere in Germany or France.
And what would you do to help them?
No,
they would want you to stay here, safe, with me.
He nuzzled me playfully. He was right, of course, I had told myself, lulled by his lips upon my neck. But still, the worry nagged. Then one day, the letter came.
Dearest Ingrid, we have disbanded the circus.
Papa's tone was matter of fact, no plea for help, though I could only imagine his anguish at taking apart the family business that had flourished for more than a century. It did not say what they would do next, or if they would leave, and I wondered if that was by design. I wrote immediately, begging him to tell me what their plans were, if they needed money. I would have brought the whole family to Berlin and fit them into our apartment. But that would have only meant drawing them closer to the danger. In any event, the point was moot. My letter came back unopened. That had been 6 months earlier, and there had been no word. Where had they gone?
Ingrid!
Herr Neuhoff booms as he enters the sitting room. If he is surprised to see me, he gives no indication. Herr Neuhoff is not as old as my father, and in my childhood memories, he had been dashing and handsome, if portly, with dark hair and a mustache. But he is shorter than I remembered, with a full stomach and just a gray fringe of hair. I rise and start toward him.
Then, seeing the small swastika pin on his lapel, I stop. Coming here had been a mistake.
"For appearances," he says hastily.
"Yes, of course. But I am not sure whether to believe him. I should just go. His face appears genuinely glad to see me, though. I decide to take a chance." He gestures to a chair overlaid with lace, and I sit, perching uneasily.
"Cognac?"
he offers. I falter.
"That would be lovely."
He rings a bell, and the same woman who answered the door brings in a tray. One house servant, where there used to be many. The Circus Neuhof has not been left untouched by the war. I feign a sip from the glass she offers me. I do not want to be rude, but I need to keep my head about me to figure out where I am going from here. There is no resting place for me in Darmstadt anymore.
"You've just come from Berlin?"
His tone is polite, one step short of asking what I am doing here.
"Yes. Papa wrote that he disbanded the circus."
Herr Neuhof's brow creases with his unspoken question. "The circus broke up months ago. Why have I come now?"
"More recently, I lost contact, and my letters came back unanswered," I add. "Have you heard from them?"
"I'm afraid nothing," he replies.
"There were only a few of them left at the end. All of the workers had gone."
"Because it was illegal to work for the Jews." My father had treated his performers and even the manual laborers like family, caring for them when they were sick, inviting them to family celebrations, such as my brother's bar mitzvahs. He'd given generously to the town, too, doing charity shows for the hospital and donating to the political officials to curry favor, trying so very hard to make us one of them. We had nearly forgotten that we weren't. Herr Neuhof continues.
"I went looking for them, you know, after. But the house was empty. They were gone, though whether they went on their own or something had happened, I couldn't say."
He walks to the mahogany desk in the corner and opens a drawer.
"I do have this."
He reveals a kiddush cup, and I rise, fighting the urge to cry out at the familiar Hebrew letters.
"This was yours, no?"
I nod, taking it from him. How had he gotten it? There had been a menorah as well, and other things. The Germans must have taken those. I run my finger along the edge of the cup. On the road, my family would have gathered in our rail car just to light the candles and share a bit of whatever wine and bread could be found. A few minutes of just us. I see shoulders pressed close to fit around the tiny table. My brothers' faces illuminated by candlelight. We were not so very religious. We had to perform on Saturdays and had not managed to keep kosher on the road. But we clung fast to the little things. A moment's observance each week. No matter how happy I had been with Eric, some part of my heart always drifted from the gay Berlin cafes back to the quiet Sabbaths. I sink down once more. I should never have left.
"The Germans still would have put your father out of business," he points out.
"If I had been here, though, perhaps the Germans would not have forced my family from their home, or arrested them, or done whatever had caused them to not be here any longer. My connection to Eric, which I had held up like such a shield, had in the end proved worthless." Herr Neuhof coughs once, then again, his face reddening. I wonder if he is ill.
"I'm sorry I can't be of more help," he says when he has recovered. "You'll go back to Berlin now?"
I shift awkwardly. "I'm afraid not." It has been 3 days since Eric returned unexpectedly early from work to our apartment. I threw myself into his arms.
"I'm so glad to see you," I exclaimed. "Dinner isn't quite ready yet, but we could have a drink."
He spent so many nights at official dinners or buried in his study with papers. It seemed like forever since we'd shared a quiet evening together. He did not put his arms around me, but remained stiff.
"Ingrid," he said, using my full name and not the pet name he'd given me. "We need to divorce."
Divorce? I wasn't sure I had ever said the word before. Divorce was something that happened in a movie or a book about rich people. I didn't know anyone who had ever done it. In my world, you married until you died.
"Is there another woman?"
I croaked, barely able to manage the words. Of course there was not. The passion between us had been unbreakable until now. Surprise and pain flashed over his face at the very idea. "No." And in that one word, I knew exactly the depths of his love, and that this awful thing was hurting him. So why would he even say it?
"The Reich has ordered all officers with Jewish wives to divorce," he explained.
How many, I wondered, could there possibly be? He pulled out some documents and handed them to me, with smooth, strong hands. The papers carried a hint of his cologne. There was not even a spot for me to sign. My agreement or disagreement irrelevant. It was fait accompli.
"It has been ordered by the Führer," he adds.
His voice was dispassionate, as though describing the day-to-day matters that went on in his department. "There is no choice."
"We'll run," I said, forcing the quaver from my voice. "I can be packed in half an hour."
Improbably, I lifted the roast from the table, as though that was the first thing I would take.
"Bring the brown suitcase."
But Eric stood stiffly, feet planted.
"What is it?"
"My job," he replied. "People would know I was gone." He would not go with me. The roast dropped from my hands, plate shattering, the smell of warm meat and gravy wafting sickeningly upward. It was preferable to the rest of the immaculate table, a caricature of the perfect life I thought we'd had. The brown liquid splattered upward against my stockings, staining them. I jutted my chin defiantly.
"Then I shall keep the apartment."
But he shook his head, reaching into his billfold and emptying the contents into my hands.
"You need to go now."
"Go where? My family was all gone. I did not have papers out of Germany." Still, I found my suitcase and packed mechanically, as if going on holiday. I had no idea what to take. 2 hours later, when I was packed and ready to go, Eric stood before me in his uniform, so very much like the man I had spied in the audience beyond the lights the day we met. He waited awkwardly as I started for the door, as if seeing out a guest. I stood in front of him for several seconds, staring up beseechingly, willing his eyes to meet mine.
"How can you do this?" I asked.
He did not answer.
"This is not happening," a voice inside me seemed to say.
In other circumstances, I would have refused to go. But I had been caught off guard, the wind knocked out of me by an unexpected punch. I was simply too stunned to fight.
"Here."
I pulled off my wedding band and held it out.
"This isn't mine anymore."
Looking down at the ring, his whole face seemed to fall, as if realizing for the first time the finality of what he was doing. I wondered in that moment if he would tear up the papers that decreed our marriage over and say,
We would face the future together, whatever the odds. He swiped at his eyes. When his hand moved away, the hardness of the new Eric, as I called him in the recent months, when it had all seemed to change, reappeared. He pushed the ring away, and it clattered to the floor. I hurried to pick it up, cheeks stinging from the roughness of his once gentle touch. "You keep it," he said. "You can sell it if you need money." As if the one thing that bound us together meant so little to me, he fled the apartment without looking back, and in that moment, the years we shared seemed to evaporate and disappear. Of course, I do not know Herr Neuhoff well enough to tell him any of this. "I've left Berlin for good," I say, firmly enough to foreclose further discussion. I run my finger over my wedding band, which I had put on once more as I'd left Berlin, so as to attract less attention while traveling.
"So where will you go?"
Herr Neuhoff asks. I do not answer.
"You should leave Germany,"
he adds gently. Leaving. It was the thing that no one talked about anymore. The door that had closed. I'd heard Mama suggest it once, years earlier, before things had gotten bad. Then the idea had seemed laughable. We were Germans, and our circus had been here for centuries. In hindsight, it was the only option. But none of us had been wise enough to take it, because no one knew how bad things would become. And now that chance was gone.
"Or you could join us,"
Herr Neuhoff adds.
"Join you?"
The surprise in my voice borders on rude. He nods.
"Our circus. I am missing an aerialist since Angelina broke her hip."
I stare at him, disbelieving. Though the seasonal workers and even performers might transfer between circuses, one circus family working for another is unheard of. I can no more imagine myself part of the Circus Neuhoff than a leopard changing its spots. The suggestion makes sense, though. And the way he phrases it does not sound as if he is offering me charity, but rather that I would be filling a need. Still, my spine stiffens. I couldn't possibly. To stay here would mean being beholden to Herr Neuhoff, another man. After Eric, I will never do that again.
"Really, you would be doing me a huge service."
His voice is sincere. I am more than just a spare performer. Having a Klempt join his circus, well, that would be something. At least to the older folks who remembered our act at its heyday. With my name and reputation as an aerialist, I am like a collectible, an item to be had. "I'm a Jew," I say. "To employ me now would be a crime. Why would he take on such danger?"
"I'm aware."
His mustache twitches with amusement.
"You are circus folk," he adds quietly.
That transcends all else. Still, my doubts linger.
"You have SS living next door now, don't you? It will be so dangerous."
He waves his hand, as if this is of no consequence.
"We'll change your name."
But my name is what he wants, the very thing that makes me most valuable to him.
"Astrid," he pronounces.
"Astrid," I repeat, trying it on for size. Close to Ingrid, but not the same. And it sounds Scandinavian, vaguely exotic. Perfect for the circus.
"Astrid Sorrow."
His eyebrows rise.
"Wasn't that your husband's surname?"
For a second, I falter, surprised that he had known. Then I nod. Eric had taken everything from me, but that he would never know.